This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice. This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast. My name is Darren Rockman, and I am a partner at Gold Rock Capital, the 21-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth families in Israel and around the world. Today, I welcome Guy Hochman to the podcast. Hi, Guy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm terrific. Thanks for joining us. So Guy is the chief behavioral officer at Plantera AI, which is an AI-based software company based on theories of behavioral psychology. He's also the head of the behavioral economics master's program at IDC Rahman University. He has his PhD in psychology from the Technion Institute of Technology in Haifa. So Guy knows a little bit about the behavior and decision-making, and that is what we're going to be talking about today. So let's start with a very big question. Are we individuals rational in the way we make our decisions?
Well, it really depends on how you define rationality, but in essence, we know today that people are not completely rational in their decisions.
Okay. And that's a little bit of a problem for economists, because they always assumed that people were rational.
Right. So we know today, for example, that, you know, people don't save enough for, you know, for rainy days. People don't make the best decisions or the most optimal decisions for themselves. It's a big problem for economists, because in economics, people believe that, you know, that we are completely rational. We don't have any cognitive limitations. We are kind of supermen of the minds who can decide the best or choose the best options in any given information. But we know today that it's not true, right? We overconsume. We don't save enough money, as I said earlier, and basically we can make better decisions. I mean, you know, we are adults, and I assume most of our listeners are, and we make about, 100, 200 decisions per day. And most of the decisions are okay, but they can be much better. And many of the decisions that we make are not good for us. We don't exercise enough. We don't eat healthy. We don't live a healthy life. We hurt our environment, which I think this is the big or the most irrational decision we can make. And we still do it every day. So we have a lot to improve. And by, you know, doing what I do, researching and understanding how people behave, we can get very important insights that can help us later help people make better decisions.
Okay, so it was that insight that people don't make rational decisions and attempt to deal with it that led to the whole field of behavioral finance. So can you just, for the people out there, explain what is behavioral finance and what was the news that it brought to the world?
So, you know, in behavioral economics, we talk about behavior in general. In behavioral finance, which is a related area, we specifically talk about financial decisions. Now, you know, because the differentiation between economic decision and financial decision is usually financial decisions are about money, about assets. Economic decisions is a more broader topic, and it deals with a decision that I have some utility or benefit from. So economic decision can also be what I wear in the morning when I get up. And we know, for example, that Mark Zuckerberg and Barack Obama, they always wore the same outfit because they say themselves, you know, I don't have time to make such an unimportant decision. I have more important decision to make. So I decide once that I'm going to wear, like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg always wore a gray T-shirt. So this is what he wears, and he doesn't have to waste time because he have far more important things to do than to waste his time on such decisions. In right. Financial decision, we focus on decision about our money and assets, how much we save, if we save at all, where we invest, etc. So this is something that is focused more on how we deal with money.
Okay, and so behavioral economics, what was the chidush, we'd say in Hebrew? What was the news or the new insight that it offered?
So the main, I think, insight or the main, you know, the news that behavioral economics brought to the world is that people are not completely rational. First of all, I think the most important insight is that we are limited. We are limited in our memory. We are limited in our perception. We are limited in our cognitive abilities. And because we are limited and because we make decisions with our, you know, based on our perception, based on our memory, based on our cognitive processing, we are limited in that sense. However, at the beginning, when Herbert Simon, he was the first to kind of talk about the fact that we are limited, economics still believe that people do the best they can under the limitation. So Simon called it, we are not maximizer. We don't try to maximize our utility. We try to find the utility that is good enough. So we are not maximizer, we are satisfiers. So a good example of that will be that if I'm hiring new employees, so the economics perspective will say I need to search all the people in the world and to find the best employee. This is maximizing, but I can't do that. I don't have the time. I don't have the ability to search the entire world for new employees. So I advertise an ad. I wanted ad. I interview about, I don't know, 5-6 people, and if out of these 6, there is one who is good enough, I will hire her or him. So it should be good enough. And as long as it's good enough, this means that I am rational because I do the best I can under the limitation. Today, we know that even when we settle for less than the best.
Less than perfect.
We don't want to
actually interview like 4 billion people.
Right, exactly. But still, we do have limitations, and we do sometimes influenced by things that are completely irrelevant to the decision. Sometimes, if we continue with this example of hiring someone, so I need to hire people based on merits, how good they are at the job, whether they can do, the thing that I need them to do. If I like them or not, if I feel good about them in my company, this shouldn't be relevant, economically, but it is very relevant psychologically. And we know today that these psychological factors, that sometimes they can be relevant. For example, when I decide who to marry, right? Who to spend my life with.
Right.
I think that a good decision would be a decision in which I will feel good about it also. But sometimes when I do business with someone, I don't need to love them. I don't even need to like them in order to have a good deal. But people can differentiate between, the relevant information and the irrelevant information when making decisions. And this is why our decisions are not completely rational, because they are affected by things that are not, they shouldn't affect the decision.
Okay. So in 2009, you co-published a paper, and you looked at the advantages and the disadvantages of quick and intuitive financial decisions. I see it, I like it, I buy it. So what were the, and you compared that to, the sort of more analytical approach, right? Spend your time, do your research, break it up into all different, pieces, and then, weigh the cost and the benefits. So what were some of the disadvantages of the sort of analytical approach, which, one would think, would be the better approach, or the one that's more likely to lead you to an optimal decision?
Right. So I want to give an example. So let's say I'm trying to solve a very complicated mathematical equation.
Okay.
I can invest a lot of time and a lot of cognitive effort in trying to solve the problem. But if I don't have the right, the proper knowledge in order to solve the problem, then it doesn't matter how much time and how much effort I invest, I will never reach an optimal solution to the problem. This is exactly the problem with decision making. If I think about all the available information, I really think through, and I invest a lot of time, and I have pros and cons about why to choose that option and not this option, And still, I don't use the relevant information, then it doesn't matter how long, for how long I make the decision, it doesn't matter how much information I weigh in, I won't reach to the optimal conclusion because I don't use the right information. So whenever we have complicated decision that we have to make about where to invest our money, what, you know, how much to save, et cetera, how much I'm going to need.
What loan should I take? What mortgage should I take?
And by the way, we don't take loans. We buy loans, but we use, you know, a very specific terminology. And it also affects, it could affect our decisions, right? Because when I think about taking a loan, so it's not very hard to take something, right? So I can take a loan. But if I thought about it as buying, because this is actually what we do, right? We buy a loan, we don't take it. We pay, and we pay a lot of money for the loans that we take. So we would we might treat it a little bit differently. So the first thing or the first disadvantage that we have about, you know, rational or analytical considerations is that we don't always use the right information, especially in complicated situations when we don't have the information that we need in order to make the right decision.
Okay. So how do we know whether we're going to have the information required and the tools?
So sometimes we can't know, and sometimes the decision is too complicated because let's say that I want to buy a new house. I have money and I want to buy a house. How can I tell, you know, I have several criteria, right? Sometimes I want a house that will be big enough, that will be in a good location, that the price should be right, the room should be big enough, etc. So there are many different criteria that I want to evaluate my options. And maybe I have two, maybe I have 10 options to choose from. Some of these options will be higher on some of the criteria, but lower on the other criteria. So we have to make lots of trade-offs. And psychologically, it's very hard because what is more important, the price or the location? The fact that I feel good or the fact that I am close to a shopping center? I mean, these are the things that, you know, they are very hard to quantify. And even when I quantify, I don't know what is more important and what might be more important in the future. And this is why it's very hard to make such decisions. And basically, in economics, they say we know what is right and what is wrong. But in psychology, we say it might be right today, it might be wrong tomorrow. So choose sometimes, especially when you don't have all the information and you can't even have the information that you need in order to make the most optimal decision, just go with your gut feel. Because this can be good enough, sometimes even better than thinking about everything. It takes too long and it doesn't ensure that you will make the right decision.
Right. That's really fascinating. So you're saying that at some point in time, we almost have information overload or trade-off overload, and then we just go for something that's, you know, hard to quantify, hard to explain, but, you know, sort of sits somewhere in our animalistic selves and run with that.
Exactly. And, you know, a very good demonstration is that let's imagine that I want to buy a new TV. I go to the store today or I go online to some website. There are literally dozens and dozens of models. I mean, which model will be better for me? I don't know. And we know today that the more options you have, which, you know, economically should be better because you have more to choose from, it makes it very hard to make a decision because whenever I choose one model, I forgo so many models. So I have higher possible regret. I am less satisfied with my decision because I left so many unselected options in the store that might be better. And every time that, you know, I experience some difficulty with the decision that I made, for example, you know, you don't see very well, or, you know, once a very specific color doesn't seem very accurate on the screen. So I think to myself, wow, what would have happened if I chose a different model? And the more models I have to choose from, the more I wonder and the more I get, you know, unsatisfied and less certain and happy about my choice.
Right. Let me take you back to the beginning of our conversation. You gave a couple of examples where people make very bad decisions, you know, overweight, ruined environment, don't save enough for retirement. So how does that fit with what you were saying just now about gut decisions, where so many of the gut decisions that we see people make, you know, people have known that smoking is bad for you now for decades, yet we see lots of people that smoke. How do those two things fit together?
So first of all, and I can give one piece of advice to our listeners, is it's very important to make the right decisions from the beginning. By right decision, I don't mean, you know, the best, you know, the optimal economic decision, but make decisions that are good for you. For example, if you haven't started to smoke, don't, because it's very hard to stop. There was a French author and philosopher once said, it's harder to find someone who only did something wrong once than who never made any mistake or never did something wrong. Why? Because once you did it, once you crossed the line, it's very hard to come back.
Right.
It's very important because, and people don't realize it, the decision we make in the past influence what we'll make, the decision that we'll make in the present and in the future. So it's very important to make good decisions because it will affect us later on in life. Now, I'm not saying that every time, sometimes, you know, making gut feeling or based on your gut feeling, making, you know, intuitive choices can be better, especially when, you know, I meet someone, I have no information about him, and I need to evaluate him because maybe we need to go into business, I need to know if I can trust him. So, you know, I can think about it until tomorrow. I don't have the right, the information I need in order to make a wise decision. And so I can, and our research showed that making gut feelings, decisions, you know, based on your gut feeling, make us or help us make better decisions. So in situation in which, you know, intuition is important or the task at hand require intuitive processes, it's better to make intuitive decisions. In situations that are more complex and I don't have the right tools or I don't have the right information, then there is no advantage in doing analytical or making analytical decisions. And so instead of wasting time and thinking through, and you know, when you think about things too much, maybe you're also increasing the chances that you will make a mistake, then use your gut feelings. It might be right, it might be wrong, but it won't be more wrong than doing a more wise decision.
Okay. So that also then ties into personality types. And there was a study that was published last year in the Journal of Financial Planning, where they found that there is a high correlation between personality types and financial outcomes. So certain personalities tend to have better financial outcomes than others. So how does that tie in to what you were saying just now? How does that tie into the types of people that are likely to use to make better financial decisions if they rely on their intuitive their intuition versus the types of people that may not be? And how do I know if I'm in the first category or the second?
So first of all, we know that, you know, relying on intuitive or analytical processes is a personality trait. We can, you know, train people, we can encourage them to rely more on their gut or to rely more on, you know, analytical processes. Mm-hmm. But there are people that are naturally more inclined to make gut decisions, and people are more inclined to, you know, to think through about everything before making a decision. In any field and in psychology in specific, we first try to understand what the majority of people are doing and what influence the majority of people. And then after we get good insights about what are the environmental factors that influence our decisions, for example, what are the specific individual personality traits that are, you know, are more connected to specific behaviors and tendencies because I think, you know, for example, if you want to influence people to help them make better decisions, so first we want to do something that will influence the majority of people. Mm-hmm. After we influence about, I don't know, sometimes, you know, you influence 50%, 60%, it's good, but it's not enough. And then there's the remaining 50, 40, 60, no matter how many, percent of the population that needs specific tailor-made influences. And this is where, you know, personality traits come into the picture. And I think that this is the future of behavioral economics, is to better understand the correlations and the connections between personality traits and the different biases and the different behavioral tendencies, in order not only to affect the masses, but also to be able to affect individual people based on their personality traits.
It's almost like targeted medicine. You know, you start to understand people's specific personality traits, and then you work out how to influence them. Sounds a little dangerous, to be honest.
It's dangerous, like anything in life. You know, even dynamite. It was invented to do good, to help us, you know, break walls and but it can be used. For negative purposes. Even here, when in behavioral economics, we try to better understand people in order to help them make better decisions. But marketers, for example, can use it in order to convince us to buy things that we don't need.
Use it and do use it.
Yes, right. Yeah. So, you know, this is a double-edged sword, but right. I think that if we use this knowledge responsibly, we can create a better culture and a better society.
So, Guy, you mentioned biases before. And that's obviously a very key part to any description or any study of behavioral economics. What are some of the most problematic biases that you see when it comes to people having to make important financial decisions?
So the first thing is that what we call the present bias. So we care more about what happens right here and right now than what will happen in the future, even though, you know, obviously it's important what happens now, but we also need to consider the future. Now, even economics will argue that, you know, people need to discount utility in the future because, you know, 100 shekels now is more than 100 shekels in a year. But the decline in utility is not linear. It's hyperbolic in a sense that we give more weight to things right here and right now. So, for example, if I will ask you what you prefer, that I will give you 100 shekels now or come back tomorrow and I'll give you 120 shekels. So people will say, you know what, give me the 100 shekels now. I'm not going to wait until tomorrow to get extra 20 shekels. But if I will ask you, no, let's meet in a year and I will give you 100 shekels, or I will meet you in a year and in one day and I will give you 120 shekels. Then most people will say, you know what, I'm waiting a year. I will wait another day to get the extra 20 shekels. So, you know, we are not willing to wait for the 20 shekels now. But we will wait in the future, which means
I would be asking for your balance sheet.
Yes, right. So even, you know, if you can trust me in everything and I can guarantee that you will get the money. But, you know, we say, who knows what will happen in the future? I know what happens now and now I want to get my money. You know, so this is one thing. We give more too much weight to our utility in the future, in the present, and not enough in the future. So this is one bias that prevents us from saving, because, you know, if I save my money now, I will benefit in the future. But what happens now when I want, you know, I see the new iPhone that I want to buy and I see the new car that I want to get. So I don't care about what will happen in the future. I care what happens now. So this is one bias that kind of prevents us from making good financial decisions. The second thing is that we are overly optimistic and overconfident. So we think that we know everything. We think that that there is a high chance that good things will happen to us and low chances that negative things, bad things will happen to us. And this is why we tend to, you know, overspend. We believe that everything will be okay. We will have money in the future. Everything will be fine. So this very strong behavioral tendency to believe that everything will be okay and the future is very bright for us, kind of helps us make, you know, rash decisions in the present. And another thing is that we think that our, this is called the projection bias, is that we think that things will not change. So if I do something now, if I like something now, I will like it later. And so everything will stay the same, so everything is okay. And we don't understand that things change.
Right.
Things change, and what I like today is not necessarily what I will like in a year or even in 2 weeks.
And to finish off, you know, given that you talked about the present bias, you know, that our tendency to see the world as, you know, overly through rose glasses and the projection bias, what can investors do to try and maybe mitigate some of those biases when they make financial decisions? Is awareness of those biases helpful? Are there practices that are helpful?
Yeah, so first of all, it's important to understand that even, you know, financial advisors are prone to these biases.
No, so, that's not true.
So yes, believe me. So even highly trained professionals are prone to biases, especially. So it's very easy to consult, because when I explain to you what is right and what is wrong, I don't need to practice it.
Sure.
You know, so, do as I say, not as I do. However, and this is another very important bias, that we are influenced by our environment more than we understand, sometimes even more than our personality traits. So understanding this, and understanding that by designing the environment, Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein call it choice architecture, we can control people's behavior. So for example, if Thaler and Benarzi in the United States, they go to people and they say, you know, next year you're going to have a race. Will you agree to commit to saving 20% of this race to a saving plan?
Right.
And so people say, you know, it's in the future, so who cares? It's money that I'm not going to lose anything, because it's money that I'm going to add to my current budget, so I don't need it anyway. So they say, okay, after a year, they can cancel it, but most people don't, because they already committed to it. So right. Creating these, they call it nudges, so creating these small behavioral interventions that kind of at least in a way, seems to limit the free will of people. It's not, they still can do whatever they want, but we try to kind of create an environment that facilitates better behavior. And by doing that, we kind of override all the strong and very hard to override cognitive biases.
Right, can we do that for ourselves? Are we able to Yes. architect our own decision environments?
Yes. So, for example, research showed that if I take my monthly salary and I divide it to envelopes, in one envelope I put groceries, in the second gas, in the third, you know, entertainment, and in the fourth clothing, it's easier for me to control my expenses and to budget better. So we can use it. We have lots of, you know, tools that we can use as professionals, but we can use in our life. I mean, sometimes I try to influence, you know, my kids, my wife. It doesn't work all the time. I have to admit, especially my kids, they become very, my wife, no matter what I try to do, she knows me better than myself. So
right.
It doesn't work. And the kids, they become more and more sophisticated with the years.
So it's hard to
kind of manipulate them. But sometimes it works. For example, you know, when you have little kids and you want to convince them to go to the shower. So you can say, you know, you can choose between going now or in 5 minutes. So you don't really have a choice, but you know, you present it in a way that they think they do, and they choose to go in 5 minutes. And then, you know, after 2 minutes, you say, 5 minutes are done, and said, okay, so.
Right, right. I believe some generals do the same thing for presidents, but yeah, that's another
right. Yes, I know. Okay. By the way, it doesn't always help. You know, in the previous American administration, they tried to manipulate President Trump sometimes, but it never worked.
It didn't work. All right. Well, Guy Achman, that was really fascinating. And we could go on for a lot longer, but our time is up. So thank you very, very much for spending time talking to us about your areas of research. And it's really been fascinating.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Okay, terrific.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for everybody for watching and for listening. We're available on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, anywhere you get your podcast. And if you've got ideas for future episodes, please send us an email to podcast@goldrockcap.com, and we will see you next time. Thanks, Guy. Thanks, everybody.